Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another fantastic hour with the FIA Group. My name is Adam Russo, and we are here today to talk about a changing industry, navigating the current events. There's a lot going on, a lot of cases to talk about, a lot of issues that are going on in the industry, so we have an hour packed. With me, as always, is my Senior VP and General Counsel, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
Also, as usual, we have John Javelin. Say hello, John.
Good morning.
And we have Chris Aguiar. Hopefully he'll get more than one slide today. People have been petitioning us to make, I think it's like a moveon.org petition to give Chris more slides. So we made sure we did. Unfortunately, folks, we're sorry. Jennifer McCormick is not in the office today. She will not be joining us. I know she's a fan favorite, so hopefully Ron, John, Chris, and myself can make up for missing out on Jen. So, as always, feel free to text us in the box there. Send us your questions. If we have time at the end, we'll get back to you. As always, this webinar is recorded. The slides will be available by tomorrow on our website. You can look at not only this webinar, but all the past ones we've done if you ever want to just read up on our old ones. And I can tell you it's nice to see Ron and John. I know all of us and Chris. Sorry, Chris. We're all on the road. We do a lot of speaking engagements. We're traveling, and it's a busy time, as it is for most of you out there. So we're just excited to be here and excited to give you an action-packed hour. As always, just be sure to know that you can feel free to contact PGC Referral for all your consulting needs. This is literally for anything. As you guys all know, we get hundreds of emails a month. People always often ask us, you know, how come you guys gave us that answer to that question so quickly? And we typically tell people, it's because we get so many emails to PGC Referral that we continuously see the same questions over and over again. So please keep the questions coming so that we can stay on top of what's happening in the industry. We think of ourselves as innovators in this industry and in the self-funding space. So if it's happening, we want to know about it. Please feel free to contact us at pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. Okay, what are we going to talk about? Folks, we have two overview slides. This is just the first one. We're going to talk about the rising cost of healthcare, a big reason why so many people are actually looking to self-fund for the first time. We're noticing a lot of media attention now being brought to the actual cost of care, looking at facilities versus looking at why insurance companies are charging so much. They're actually saying, well, why are the hospitals charging so much? Mm-hmm. Or why are these pharmaceutical organizations charging so much? We know about all those stories. Next, we're going to talk about our favorite Montego case, Chris Aguiar, our subrogation expert here at FIA. We'll make sure we talk about the latest Supreme Court case. For some reason, and it's funny because I'm actually writing an article now, and I know Chris wrote an article recently about it, the Supreme Court is fascinated with subrogation. They talk more about subrogation than they do in all 4 years or all 3 years of law school, I can tell you that. Next, we're going to talk about the big Michigan case going on with SIA. We're also going to talk about the new potential regulation in New Mexico. We're going to talk about the Board of Trustees case as well with our legal pundits. In addition, we're going to talk about the Santana-Diaz v. MetLife case. We're going to put some emphasis on the Kentucky Employer Safety Association case, the case that we saw recently with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts right here in our home state. We're going to talk about California and the sanctions that are being sought for failure to provide records. This is a really interesting one, folks, and something you have to look at across the country. One of the things that we didn't put on this list, but I just want you guys to make sure you're aware of, is obviously the Liberty Mutual case that came out. We talked about this previously, that came out in Vermont. It ties in very close to the SIA case in Michigan because they both relate to preemption of state laws or state regulations or a quote-unquote overreach by state entities to get ask for money or ask for certain things from self-funded employers and their administrators. Last but not least, how to protect the plan. If any of these two overview slides have shown anything, is there's a lot more litigation out there. For whatever reason, whether it's because healthcare is on the rise, not only charges, but the coverage in the media, whatever it might be, the reality is the plan needs to be protected now more than ever because a lot of these cases are coming back and looking at brokers, not as middlemen, but they're looking at brokers as actual advisors. Advisors meaning experts. Experts meaning fiduciaries. I can tell you many times we sit here and we've actually thought, have we crossed the line from giving an expert opinion or friendly advice to becoming an expert now based on what we wrote. So with that, first we're going to talk about the rising cost of healthcare. And this is interesting stuff, folks. Please feel free if you want to get a copy of these slides. You know about our website, but these are interesting information for anyone out there that's looking to get additional self-funded lives. This is some really good information. We have seen 5 million new employee lives come to self-funding in 2016. That is a fact. Almost all of our clients across the board are seeing an increase in the number of requests for proposals, an increase in interest, an increase in enrollment, an increase in the number of groups they're administrating. There's just a lot of new business going around the industry, and it's everyone taking a piece of that 5 million lives that are out there. We also know from the CNN Money article back on March 30th that Obamacare patients are sicker and pricier than expected. Well, I don't know who thought of this than expected. I can tell you that we've been saying that we would think this would happen. We knew they would get sicker. However, what we know is that the cost of care for an exchange member is 22% higher than for a self-funded health plan member. They're going to bring up the fact that it's adverse selection, that, you know, these employers, these bad employers like FIA, right? We're a self-funded plan. I look at Chris and go, man, that's a sick guy. Let's put him on the exchange. Hey, Chris, here's $5,000. We don't want you on our self-funded plan. Instead, we're going to put you on the exchange plan, the Massachusetts Connector plan.
We just fire him.
Oh, just fire them. Exactly right.
Yeah, somebody else's problem now.
What do? We actually find ways to incentivize Chris to be healthier. We look at hospitals and say, hey, listen, is there a cheaper way for us to provide, for you guys to provide this service? Is there a way for us to incentivize steerage to certain facilities that are cheaper? That's why the cost of care is less. It's because self-funded employers are actually doing things in their plan design that are not being done in the fully insured world or in the exchange world. That's what we know. I love this. The study showed that, quote, Obamacare members have higher rates of costly illnesses such as diabetes, depression, hypertension, heart disease, HIV, and hepatitis C. Now, the depression one, maybe if they work for a self-funded plan, they wouldn't be as depressed. I mean, I know you guys love your job and are so happy to have the health plan that you have, right?
Oh, man, to the stars.
I mean, you guys got to see Ron smile. I've never seen Ron smile this much in my life. So, real quick, for those of you to know, UnitedHealthcare expected, this is all from the article, expects to lose $1 billion in 2015 and 2016. A billion. Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina, $282 million in loss in 2015, and because of that, raised their rates by 32.5% in response. I can tell you just based on the conferences that I've been going to lately, the TPAs that we've been working with, they've seen over the past 5 years premium increases of under 4% over that period of time. 1% increases in per year, 2% per year, 32%. So for those of you who still don't think that working with a self-funded employer, being a self-funded plan or working with an administrator makes sense, look to see what the premium increase and the cost increase have been to these self-funded employers across the country. And it's because of these losses that both of these organizations are considering leaving the ACA exchanges and marketplace in 2017. Ron?
Yeah, you know, Adam, it's interesting. I actually, just this morning, believe it or not, I was reading an article about the cost of joining the exchanges and how it's impacting the individuals who are actually purchasing the policies, so the policyholders, the members. And it's funny because the author clearly had a pro-exchange, pro-Obamacare spin, and he was talking about how all this news is out there about how much more expensive it is to get the policies every year, that the claims are, the cost is rising to be insured, that it's much more expensive than people thought, that the actual health of the people who are in the exchange are running up the cost. And then he said, oh, but you know what people are not talking about is all the tax subsidies. You see, the costs are going up, but the actual individuals who are buying the policies, they're not the ones who are being burnt by the rising cost. So it's all okay.
Right,
which is so funny because I'm thinking, all right, so where's the money coming from? You're talking about the taxpayers? You know, somebody's paying for it. But it's just so funny that the emphasis is, oh, yeah, it's much more expensive to be on the exchange than we thought it was, but don't worry about it. That's what the tax credits are for.
And that's funny because I just did a speech, you know, two speeches over the past week, and in both situations I talked about what is the cost of care to a member. And people are like, oh, you know, $100,000 these bills. I'm like, guys, the members do not see a $100,000 bill. The member sees their copay and deductible. That's what they see. And unless you can incentivize people to go to one facility over another, there's no reason to do so. Here's what we know. Looking at our own healthcare at our own population, we know that to deliver a baby, no complications to regular delivery, at one hospital here in Boston, costs $30,000. Another hospital located down the street is $10,000. Who knows that? Nobody. The only people that know that are us. And literally, we find out many times after the fact. We find out, well, you're telling me I could have went to that facility and paid $10,000 instead of $30,000? What is the copay deductible in our plan currently for both women, both pregnant women, one who went to the $10,000 facility and one went to the
$30,000?
They paid $250. That's what they pay.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay, John. You're not pregnant. You're not a woman.
Not yet.
$250. There's no reason for them to go to one over the other.
Right.
We need to give them an incentive to go to one or the other, and that's what we've done. What do we do? I don't know. How about $2,000 worth of diapers?
Right.
Maybe that incentivizes somebody to pick one facility over another. Ron?
But Adam, surely the hospital that costs $30,000 has better outcomes.
Right. Their kids are three times better looking,
that's it,
than the other hospital. They're three times smarter than the other. I was born in St. Margaret's Hospital, okay? It doesn't exist anymore, okay? They should have condemned the place before. I mean, look how I turned out. Well, maybe I'm a bad example. The point being is that your people need to realize what those costs are. So I love people say, well, we have high deductible health plans. Okay, but on those high deductible health plans, it's still a $100,000 claim. They're paying the first eight.
Yeah, you're going to burn through that.
They're paying the first two. It doesn't make a difference still. Even in this hospital situation, one hospital was 10, the other one was 30. Their $2,000 high deductible plans are still not making a difference whether they go to the $10,000 facility or the 30. You got to incentivize the members.
Yeah.
So, Ron, I know you wanted to talk about the next slide because you thought this was really cool stuff.
We could literally hang out on this slide forever, but one of the things that is out there as far as the media is concerned, Adam and I are talking about $100,000 claims. We're talking about hemophiliacs and preemies, and you guys know the good stuff, right? The cancer centers and the children's hospitals and these claims that are astronomical. But what's interesting is when you're talking to a layman, they're not thinking in terms of hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in these claims. They're thinking about these real-life examples that really hit home, things that they could actually see impacting them. So an example would be something like a bandage, right, or a Q-tip, or I love this one. What is it? The mucus recovery system. It's a box of tissues. And what I love about this is back in 2013, February of 2013, you might recall Stephen Brill wrote that article. It was a complete issue of Time Magazine, a special report, The Bitter Pill, Why Medical Bills Are Killing Us. And he covered a lot of these types of claims. And I know people like, we saw that he's talking about how a bag of solution, which cost the hospital 50 cents, that they're charging $500, you know, obviously, I'm thinking to myself, well, that's not going to bankrupt the plan, but I figured that that was something that was going to have a real impact. Unfortunately, those interesting examples and the hypotheticals that he brings up were lost in page after page of very technical text. So the thing is, I think that as people who have direct access to the public, to these plan members, we need to make these examples known. Right? They need to understand that this is where their benefits are going.
But the funny thing is, right, when you bring up the slide, is that, to be honest, right, in the big scheme of things, the next slide is really what matters to me. If every one of my clients had to pay $985 for a pair of scissors, I'm okay with that. As long as the real, real expensive stuff is dealt with.
Right.
But this is what's important to your membership.
Correct.
This is the stuff that sells. Telling people, like, if I go somewhere, if I'm in a party run, right, let's just say it's Friday night, I go somewhere and people say, oh, like, I'm with my wife and her friends, you know, I have to hang out with her. Who wants to hang out with their wife's friends? Nobody does. But when you do it, you got to do it. And they go, oh, what do you do for it? Oh, I help my client save money. Oh, what do you mean? Well, you know, dialysis.
You lose them.
I go, you know that there are hospitals that charge $985 for a pair of scissors. Really?
Yeah.
What? Yeah, and they charge $11 for a box of tissues. What? They can get that.
Exactly.
That's why this is sellable to the masses. Whereas if I walk up to somebody and go, well, can you believe that for end-stage renal disease, they're charging 10 times the cost of Medicare? They're like, is that good? I don't know what that means.
Exactly.
This is why you need to tell to the membership, This is what you're fighting. But the next slide, this is what you're really fighting, right?
Right.
This is what we all care about, not the slide before. And these, in our minds, Ron, I love your take on this, are some of, and even John, you guys fight these claims all the time. You guys negotiate. I know the implants are big here. We do a lot of air ambulance here. We do a lot of dialysis, all carve-outs, all things that we're trying to negotiate. We're trying to get sign-off on the claims. You know, how typical, when you say are typically foreign, I mean, John,
yeah.
Is this real?
Absolutely.
I mean, what are we talking about?
On the low side in a lot of these estimates.
Sure.
When I was putting these numbers together for air ambulance, for example, I put 400 to 500% of Medicare allowable rates. In reality, that is really on the low side of what we see. I mean, we've seen up to 1,200, 1,300% of Medicare. I mean, those are less common, but they certainly happen.
When they have an unlimited right to charge whatever they want, or at least they think they do, honestly, limiting yourself to 400 or 500% Medicare is pretty generous. It's funny we bring this up because just yesterday I was looking at a letter from a air ambulance company, and obviously I can't go into detail, but they talk about a few things. One, they say that because they're providing emergency services, even though they're an out-of-network provider, the plan is required to pay 100% of billed charges. Now, I don't know where they come up with that, but they're basically saying if we're out of network and it's an emergency service, we're required by law to provide the service, and you're required by law to pay whatever we charge, which I don't even know where that comes from further. And also, it's not an emergency service if the person's already stabilized at one facility and they're airlifting them to the facility across the street because they didn't want to have to cross the road on foot.
Forget across the street. I mean, we see air ambulances taking people from Hawaii to Texas. I mean, a lot of it is comfort-based. I mean, sure, there's emergency transport that needs to be done, and that's, of course, a much different situation than when you're being flown just across the country because either you don't feel like driving or you have a private plane and don't feel like taking it.
Yeah, this is something cool that I heard. You know, as you guys may know, I talk to a lot of our clients. I try to call the presidents of our clients on a daily basis, and I ask, hey, what do you see? How about this one? Urgent care facilities, like you know how we have urgent care all around here, right?
Sure.
There are standalone urgent care where the people that go to them think it's a freestanding urgent care facility, so you're thinking it's like it's a cheaper claim because you're going into an urgent care.
Versus the ER.
Owned by the hospital. Hospital still billing it.
As an ER?
No.
Yeah. That's ridiculous.
And this is happening a lot, I guess. And I'm looking at our audience. We have Jason Davis. Jason Davis is here from Canada visiting us. He's in our audience. And Gary Cunn is also here. Jason, say, where'd you stay, Jason? In Florida?
Florida is the worst.
So we're seeing a lot of this. Folks, if you have these issues, I don't have to say it, but I'm going to say it. You know who to call. Call Ron. Call us. This is what we're here to help you with. Hey, real quick, I mentioned Garrick. Before we get into the real legal stuff, you know, Garrick tomorrow, I believe, is doing his first public speaking ever as an employee of FIA. I feel bad for the kid. I mean, I feel bad for the audience.
I feel bad for us.
Yeah. I mean, they're hoping to get Ron and me, and they're stuck with him. But best of luck to you. Best wishes to you tomorrow in your first speech. I told you, the number one thing you got to do is not read the slides. The number one thing to do is make stories. With that, Chris, I hope you don't read this next slide. Chris, talk to us about the Supreme Court case.
I don't have to read the next slide because I wrote it, and I know more about this case than I know about almost anything else. Folks, I mean, really simple, right? So if you haven't already heard about Montanil, you're either not listening to us or I'm not doing my job. Because the reality of the matter is, in the subrogation world, Montanil is all the rage. Very quickly, January 20th, the Supreme Court came out and said, it's not a quote, but it might as well be, hey, plan participant, if you get into an accident, you get hurt, and you get a settlement, take your money and run to the casino. Get rid of that cash as soon as you can, and your plan won't be able to come after you for it. That is the law as it stands today. Obviously, that's an oversimplification, but you know, make no mistake. If you have subrogation opportunities and your plan participants have settlements in their hands, there is a clock that is ticking because as much as I'd like to say that lawyers, you know, us lawyers are very honest people that practice with integrity, the truth of the matter is most lawyers don't practice with integrity.
Oh, I wouldn't say most.
I don't know. Okay, fine. Most might be, in
an exaggeration. But in any event, do not rely on the fact that, do not rely on your hope that you get the, you know, 51% of lawyers that are practicing with integrity. And I can't, you know, I can't reiterate enough how important it is to have access to legal resources. I had a case handler just last week come into my desk. There was a slight miscommunication between the administrator because there was a senior and a junior situation, both of which were under the plan. One was not in the accident. One was no lien quickly became a $65,000 lien, and the attorney was trying to sue for fraud. A five-minute conversation with counsel at FIA, and the situation was over, and now we're getting, I think, an 80% recovery on that case. So having the ability to get a lawyer who understands ERISA law, who understands how this all works, and who understands what Montanil actually says or doesn't say is incredibly, incredibly important. You know, the clock is ticking, and if you don't have those resources, you are missing out on money because of Montanil.
For those of you who aren't working with us, you know, one, I'm sorry, and two, I would say really simply this. If you have a case, the last thing we want is an industry. Remember, our goal here at FIA, the number one thing, our number one mission is to expand employer-based healthcare. That's what our goal is. We know here that if employer-based healthcare grows, that means the costs are going down, employers are being smart, they're working with more and more administrators, they're being self-funded. If we help the industry grow, we grow. Even if you hate us, even if you never want to work with us, if you have a subrogation case where you're not responding back to the attorney, where funds are being dispersed, I get it. Okay, you have your own vendors, you have your own people that you want to utilize, whatever it might be. What I'm asking on behalf of the industry is for you not to hurt the industry by setting precedent where that lawyer now feels even more empowered to not reimburse self-funded employers, because all it's going to do is going to raise the cost for everybody. So we're asking, if you have a case where you're getting pushback from an attorney, wherever it may be, Arizona is a big spot, Michigan is a big spot, New York, Georgia, if you're in those states and you have noticed that a law firm is really pushing back on you in regards to reimbursement, trust me, it's not just affecting your one plan, it's affecting every other plan that may happen to have a case with that particular firm. And if you know how law firms are, they have those commercials, you know, Morris Bart in Louisiana is everywhere, right? There's certain firms that are just cover the entire state. We need to make sure that if any of those firms have a case, that those subrogation rights are protected on behalf of the industry as a whole. Ron, I know you want to talk about Saia's big case in Michigan.
Yeah, so a bit of a disclaimer here. The FIA Group is very much involved with the Self-Insurance Institute of America, or Saia. You know, we're on different committees and huge fans of what they do. So if over the next couple slides I kind of sound a little bit like a Saia cheerleader, I just wanted people to know ahead of time that we are involved with Saia. However, even if you look at this objectively, if you are at all involved in this industry, I think you're going to appreciate what they've been doing, what they're currently doing, and the efforts that they've put forth on your behalf, and hopefully you see the value in the efforts that they've made. The first case actually has Saia in the name, so you know it's good. It's Saia v. Rick Snyder, which is the Michigan, the governor over in Michigan, and basically what happened there is Michigan passed a law, without getting into too great detail, requiring certain reporting by benefit plans, insurance carriers, and the like, and it includes self-funded plan administrators. Okay, well, Saia made the argument that this kind of reporting and record keeping, that these are core obligations of ERISA plan administration, you know, key elements of plan administration. And as a part of plan administration, state law like this is preempted, and we only have to comply with the general federal laws. Well, the lower district court that heard the case, this was actually brought to trial by Saia, and the court, that lower district, they ended up saying that, no, this type of reporting constitutes administrative work, that it's not plan administration, and therefore it doesn't get to enjoy any of the ERISA preemption I'm talking about. Well, Saia kind of looked at it. A number of us involved kind of looked at this case and said, you know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. Let's go for broke. And so it was actually appealed. And what's fantastic is at the higher level, the Supreme Court in Michigan, they ended up remanding it back for further consideration, because as this was going on, a similar case was decided in Vermont. This is the Govia v. Liberty Mutual case. And in summary, and I don't want to spend too much time going through the details, I definitely suggest that you either look this case up, again, because it's being litigated, it's public information, or if you're at one of the SIA events and you corner Mike Ferguson, I'm sure he'd love to talk about this case. It's sort of a feather in his cap, and rightfully so.
But the reality is this, guys, how it affects you. Illinois is now looking at doing the exact same 1% tax that we saw in Michigan. If this doesn't go away, as more and more states need money to put in the bank in order to pay for their exchanges or their Medicaid plans, this is where they make money. So unless this is defeated, we're going to notice this go across the country. Here's the problem. In Vermont, it was basically an administrative burden on Liberty Mutual self-funded plans to have to give that information. That's an administrative burden that affected a self-funded plan, therefore preempted by ERISA.
Right.
If you're more than one state, you're more than one state, you have to give records if you're in Vermont. You don't have to give records if you're in New York. You're treating over state lines, you're treating them differently. You can make the same argument in this case, right, in the Sixth Circuit case with SIA. However, the situation here is a little different because it's money. So what's the administrative burden? Well, is there one? Is there not one? That's the issue.
Right.
But here's one thing. As a legal pundit, right, and we love talking about these things, why would the Supreme Court say to the state, why would they say to the appellate court, hey, because of our decision here, you might want to reconsider this?
They're giving me a chance to save face.
Right, because if it ends up that the plan loses and it goes back to the Supreme Court, maybe the Supreme Court saying that we would look at this case differently.
Right.
So who knows, but at the end of the day, how this case is going to affect everybody, it comes down to taxes. Spending more money, making the plan more costlier.
And one of the things that I like and one of the arguments that's been made is that ultimately anytime there's any kind of a reporting or disclosure or record keeping, and like Adam said, that's an actual administrative burden, it requires labor, that is clearly going to be administrative for ERISA preemption purposes. And like you say, people who say, well, this is not an administrative burden, this is a financial burden, that's where the difference is. You know, you could make the argument, okay, but who's making the payment? Who's cutting the check? Who's tracking the payments? Who's ensuring that the payments are being made and made timely? So even if the payment in and of itself is not administrative, all of the work that has to be done to make sure that the payment is being made, that is in and of itself administrative work. And I got to tell you, with tax time having just come up, right, we're all up against the gun now for filing taxes. I don't know about you guys, but if you told me that paying my taxes and filing my returns is just financial, I'd laugh at you because I've spent so much time going through these stupid forms, filling out all these checklists and did I do this and did I do that in the last year. You know, yeah, I understand it's a tax, and at the same time, it was definitely an administrative burden for me to file my own taxes.
Why don't you hire someone, Ron? You know, we expect our clients to hire experts to do their stuff for them, but you want to do this on your own? Okay. Interesting.
I am an expert. So
I know you want to talk a little bit about what's happening in New Mexico as well.
Yeah, New Mexico, you know, one of my favorite states. It is. I think it's quite beautiful. I've only been there once, and I hope to go back, especially during the winter when we're getting many feet of snow here in New England. But this is one thing about New Mexico that I'm not a huge fan of. Recently, they passed a bill which indicated that stop-loss is a form of casualty insurance and therefore could only be issued by licensed casualty carriers. But don't worry, because they're also going to potentially, again, this is just sort of rumor mongering, but may potentially also classify stop loss as health insurance. So if you're a health insurance carrier, you can issue stop loss then as well. But regardless, this clearly screws with the definition of what stop loss is and isn't as a financial insurance. It also exposes stop loss to all sorts of regulation that it hasn't been exposed to in the past. Again, talking about SIA, good for them. They've been in contact with regulators and legislators in New Mexico trying to explain what stop loss is and is not, to preserve it as a form of financial insurance, and in particular prove that it's not health insurance. But for those of us who are in the industry and actually know what stop loss is, even when you look at the bill itself, SB 108, and you look at their definition, accident and health insurance, right? And they list out a list of types of insurance. I hope nobody is offended by the list. It's alphabetical, so it's not that they like anyone more than anyone else, but they're listing out accident, death and dismemberment, credit disability, critical illness, dental, disability, home health care. Yeah, okay, you guys can all see how this relates to somebody's health and health care. And then excess or stop loss is just kind of stuck there in the list. I'm glad they call it excess or stop loss and not stop loss and excess, so at least you don't end up at the bottom of the list, because that would just be embarrassing. But the bottom line is, when you look at this list of insurance that's being included by this bill, stop loss is the one that's not like the others. And it seems clear to me that they don't really understand what it is, and it just got lumped in. Now, is it something that somebody made a mistake and with some education will correct? Or is there some underlying agenda that hopefully they were thinking would get this snuck in, and fortunately we caught it and are putting up a hurdle for them? But either way, these are the types of things you must keep an eye on, because if a bill like this just sneaks through, yeah, it seems like a small subheading or some sort of disclaimer at the bottom of the page when it comes to passing these laws, but a year or two from now, it could change how our industry works in its entirety. So, again, thank you for paying attention, and also, I want to thank those who have been involved on behalf of our industry to prevent these from going forward.
Yeah, so we're seeing more and more of this. I mean, it seems like every government relations meeting we're at, they keep on adding new states with new potential regulation going on as it relates to stop loss carriers.
So there's a lot of sneak out there.
So, Chris, I know there's a big ERISA case that you wanted to talk about. Give some background information on this one.
Yeah, if anyone doesn't like migraines and a general feeling of frustration, then I do not recommend that you read this case. There's a lot going on. Very basically, you have a plan sponsor who doesn't fund the plan.
Now, I know before we get into it, we've had a lot of clients, a lot of TPA clients, who've had this situation where they're looked upon as being stuck in the middle. Hey, Adam, the plan is bankrupt, or the plan just doesn't feel like paying the claim. They have the money, or they're bankrupt. The members are calling us. What do we do? I mean, this is a normal question. This is a great case that you can look at if you have one of those issues to see how you could actually fix your administrative service agreements with your clients as it relates to this.
And this case really takes us back to basics, right? At its core, the question really is, when is a fiduciary not a fiduciary? Because if you had asked me, does the refusal, inability, however you want to couch it, to put funds in the plan that were promised to the plan, if that doesn't make you a fiduciary, I don't know what does. Let's remember what ERISA defines a fiduciary as. Anyone who exercises control over plan assets. I would think avoiding to provide plan assets is the exercising of control. Well, the court disagreed here. The problem is the court couched it in this really awkward way, right? So what happens is the guy gets sued because he doesn't put funds into the plan.
So you see the guy, like who, what happened?
The employer. The employer got sued for not funding the plan, even though the plan document actually stated that, you know, had provisions for future assets that plan funds were defined as future funds that were to come to the plan. So everything about the plan would suggest that he was a fiduciary under ERISA. Well, he filed bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy court said, well, in this other case, we decided that he wasn't a fiduciary under ERISA because he hadn't actually put the funds into the plan. Therefore, the plan he wasn't controlling plan assets. Because he wasn't a fiduciary there, we're not going to call him a fiduciary here. And what the heck did we get out of this? The guy didn't have to put the funds into the plan. They didn't hold him responsible. And that's wild, right? And interestingly enough, it's not uncommon. In the Sixth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, that decision is effectively the same.
But who is responsible?
Great question. They didn't answer that question. They simply said that that he didn't qualify for the exception under the bankruptcy law to be able to be held responsible.
So you saying that an employer that has a self-funded plan, if they bankruptcy, they won't be held liable as a fiduciary for not paying plan assets, not paying claims?
Conceivably, yes. I'm reading it right out of the thing here. He failed to make certain required contributions. In an action by the funds to collect the unpaid contributions, the issue arose as to whether, because the trust agreements define the fund as including contributions, quote, required to be made. The unpaid contributions were plan assets so that Bose, who was the employer, not Bose, but the...
Not where your wife works.
Not where your wife works. The guy's name was B-O-S.
All right, I was panicking for
that. Who had control over BEI's funds, had liability as an ERISA fiduciary for the non-payment of the contributions. The court held that an employer's unpaid contributions to employee benefit funds are not plan assets, even if the plan document expressly defines the fund to include future payments. He was not a fiduciary of the plan.
So the plan members are paying contributions every week for their, you know, they're working, they put money into the plan.
The employer,
that money's just gone.
The employer just decided he wasn't going to contribute funds he had promised them, and the court, this court said under ERISA, they have no fiduciary.
So the members just get balance billed? I bet they'll.
Can they go after their TPA?
They're going to sue the TPA.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
I'm telling you, folks.
Very interesting case.
Don't try to read this decision. It's insane.
Where is this case out of?
This case came out of the Ninth Circuit, so California.
California, one of those things, right. A lot of fun stuff happens there. Let's go over to that next one then, Chris.
All right.
The MetLife case.
Yeah, this next case is not quite as mind-numbing as Chris's case. It's not going to make your eyes bleed. It's actually a really interesting case and one that we deal with fairly frequently with regard to plan drafting. Essentially, in this case, a member's claim was denied. The member exhausted his administrative remedies. The summary plan description and the plan document both provided 3 years to file suit. Now, that is, of course, significantly less than the time limit the state typically places on contract actions. In this state, I am honestly not sure which it is, but it's either 6 or 10 years. But the SPD said 3 years. The EOB, however, was issued without any notice of that three-year time limit.
All right, so the SPD had 3 years.
Yeah, so the
EOB didn't mention the 3 years.
Right.
And that state had, let's say, six.
Yes. The patient was certainly made aware of the three-year time limit by being given the SPD. However, the provider did not request the SPD, therefore the provider was not given a copy of the SPD. Now, because the EOB didn't say anything about the three-year time limit, and it was, you know, kind of buried deep within the SPD, not purposely, the plan wasn't trying to keep it secret, but it's a 110-page document. It's just, it's not even one line, it's half a line in 110 single-spaced pages. So naturally, nobody knew about it except for the plan and the TPA. The member sued after 4.5 years. Now, keep in mind, that's a year and a half after the plan document
allowed. So the member filed the appeal. He went through the normal administrative processes.
Yes, the member did everything he did.
After his final appeal was denied,
yes.
He then sued. But waited 4.5 years from the date of service, not the three.
Right. The plan denied the appeals as untimely, even when the provider gave notice to sue. But then the provider actually sued. What the court said is that, yes, it's in the plan document. Yes, technically, sure, the plan is allowed to do it. But if you don't tell anyone about it, you can't enforce it. I mean, the regulations surrounding ERISA literally say, and I quote, a description of the plan's review procedures and the time limits applicable to such procedures must be included on the EOB.
You would have a 20-page EOB.
Yes, I mean, if you can make your text small enough,
if
you can limit it.
It'd be like an SBC that's supposed to be limited to four pages, double-sided. But what you're saying is, the court said the EOB would have to have the language cited in the SPD, even though we all know when we read a appeal section of an SPD, it's more than a page.
And this goes back to, this is not necessarily a new issue, because under ERISA and then the plan document itself, it indicates that whenever there's an adverse benefit determination, the participant, the beneficiary, is entitled to written notification of the adverse benefit determination. And it goes on to say that you have a right to reference to the section of the plan that was relied on, any outside information or experts that were relied on, you know, what the other basis of the denial is, what your rights to appeal are, external appeal, all that stuff. It's supposed to be in this written notification of adverse benefit determination. But at the same time, and let's face it, almost every claims processor, when you deny a claim or you limit how much is paid, because remember, even a partial payment is still an adverse benefit determination, all you're doing is sending an EOB. You're not sending this 3-, 4-, 5-page letter that says, we're sorry your claim was denied. Here are your rights. Here's the rationale. You wait until there's some sort of an appeal.
But this court is pulling a lot of emphasis on the explanation of benefits.
It's they literally want to take all this and pump it into an EOB.
With the 300 TPAs we work with, 250 of them have missing things on the EOB that we think should be on there. This is not even something that we would ever advise our client, oh, by the way, include the entire procedural process as well as the litigation process in that particular state or in that particular plan doc. That's a lot of, that's a big burden on behalf of administrators.
Yeah, there have been a lot of court cases lately talking about the time frames for filing suit, and the general consensus is it can be anything as long as it's reasonable.
And you know why you're seeing this a lot? Because under the, under Obamacare, right, under the ACA, because of the increase, because of the fact that external, you have an external IRO, right? You have the appeals process, the fact that members don't have to pay for the external IRO, there's no reason not to appeal. It puts a lot more emphasis on, here's why we're going to appeal. Here's why we're going to litigate. It doesn't cost the member anything. So as more and more of these cases are seen in the light of day in a courtroom, that's why these are cases they just never saw a courtroom before. Now, courts, a lot of different judges all across the country, some liberal, some conservative, they're looking at the plan docs going, huh, you know, that's good information. You should have that on the EOB without ever thinking they've never actually worked at an insurance company. To think to put all this stuff on an EOB would be impossible in many situations. That's why you've seen a lot of these weird cases coming out.
Yeah, a bunch of years back, the DOL actually created a kind of model EOB, and it's, I think it's three full pages, just wall-to-wall text. And I'm, you know, it's probably not a bad model to go by, but for most TPAs, it is incredibly impractical.
Like, I see what they're trying to do. They're trying to protect patients. But if you give a four-page EOB, they're not going to read the four-page EOB.
Right.
I mean, telling them, please see your plan doc, which is available at www.feagroup.com, would be a lot more practical in relation to these kinds of things.
Right. I mean, just real quick before we move on, the lesson from this case essentially is that if your plan does propose a shorter timeline, what you need to do is just stick it on the EOB. It doesn't have to be the full section. It can literally just be a quick statement saying, you have X years to file a lawsuit, period.
If there's ever a case, and I'm sorry for selling FIA here, that you'd want to purchase the fiduciary protection that my company offers, that FIA offers through our PACE program, this is the case. If you want to go to your broker or your employer and go, here's why you want to outsource that final appeals decision to the FIA group in their PACE program, is because of cases like this, where the only people that are going to be blamed for this are the TPA and the potential broker or advisor. They're going to be blamed. So use this case as a reason to get your employer groups to transfer that fiduciary duty from themselves so they're not blaming you, your broker, or anybody else, or their stop-loss carrier for these types of situations. But, you know, this is the kind of case that makes me be afraid to be the fiduciary, right?
All right. Kentucky Employers Safety Association, Injured Workers Pharmacy. Injured Workers Pharmacy, interestingly, right here in Massachusetts. Essentially, in this case, and I'm not going to get into the specifics for time's sake, and because this one is another one that might make your ears bleed, but there was an arrangement here where a particular insurer used one particular method when it went to pharmacies. It used a PBM-like entity, and the details there are not terribly important, but it used this PBM-like entity to contact the pharmacy and say, will you accept a negotiated rate? If the pharmacy said yes, great. If the pharmacy said no, well, sometimes they just paid that negotiated rate anyway, the rate that they essentially would have proposed. And, you know, the plan documents were sometimes, they sometimes had proper language. They sometimes didn't. This has actually been an ongoing issue for many years in this particular case. But essentially, the issue arose when this one pharmacy refused to adjust its prices after the fact. So in this case, the member went to that pharmacy, didn't get the kind of pre-certification that it was encouraged to get. And of course, that didn't impact the member's benefits. It just didn't help the insurer be able to negotiate a price on the front end. So the insurer went to the pharmacy and said, hey, you know, I know you were already paid this amount, but will you agree to lower your price? And can you guess what the pharmacy said? They said, no, of course not. We got paid. Thanks. Have a nice day. Bye. So the insurer then carved that pharmacy out of its plan by excluding it entirely. And that itself was not necessarily a problem, except for the Kentucky law, and again, I'm not going to get into this in great detail, the Kentucky law saying that essentially pharmacies are medical providers, and it imposed certain limits on who you can and cannot carve out of your plan. Bottom line is, though, there was a dispute about the merits of the average wholesale price of the drugs. And the health plan essentially said, I don't care what the average wholesale price is, I'm going to pay what I think is fair. And the courts and the workers' comp board said average wholesale price is the average wholesale price. That's literally what it is. It is what this drug is worth. There is scarcely a better metric for figuring out what a drug is worth than by looking at what the drug is worth. I mean, it doesn't get any more kind of textbook than that. The drug, the average wholesale price is how much the drug sells for. When the plan doesn't have great language specifically saying what it will pay, the plan administrator's discretion only goes so far. You can't look at the average wholesale price and say, I disagree. Well, there's nothing to disagree with. That's just that's the price. The average wholesale price. I could repeat that word all day. It's so blatantly obvious. And that's essentially what the court said. The court said, look, average wholesale price. You can't just decide that you disagree with the average wholesale price. You have to take it into account when determining what is objectively reasonable, absent more specific language. So how does this affect you? Well, when you're drafting a plan or enforcing a plan, keep in mind what the plan's language says. If the plan's language says, we will pay anything that's reasonable, well, you're not really giving yourself a lot of latitude to decide for yourself what is reasonable. You have to look at kind of objective factors to see what the industry deems reasonable. And what the industry deems reasonable may not necessarily be what you deem reasonable. But essentially, that's not the provider's problem.
It's funny you say that. So we look at some of these plans that we notice have, you know, cost-plus language or reference-based price language or Medicare-plus language or whatever it might be. Okay, the language is there. Great. So then I'm asked many times to defend it, right? So I look at the plan doc and I can defend the language. But what I can't defend is, I'm like, how did that plan come up with the money it gave? And they couldn't give me actual data to show that what they paid was Medicare plus 40.
Yeah,
that's part of the problem. Even if you have the language, you need to make sure the data that you're getting is coming from a reliable source. And that's not always the case because many times, many people try to not spend money. Is there another way? They try to go online, they try to figure out themselves, let's just say, but there's no way to defend what they're paying. That's a real problem. In addition to having the language, you have to make sure that where you're coming up with these sources of payment, that those are reliable sources as well.
Yeah, it's that kind of black box approach that a lot of TPAs take. They send a claim to be repriced, they get a dollar amount back, and then they pay that. And when the provider says, how did you pay that? The TPA says, well, that's what the auditor told me to pay. Needless to say, that's far from an ideal way to adjudicate.
You have to defend it. So I know there's another big case that you wanted to talk about, John.
Yeah, this one's great. Also right here in Massachusetts, Stephanie C. versus Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts. This is a case that talks about discretionary authority, and this is relevant to fiduciary duties and plan drafting and all sorts of consulting work that we deal with on a almost an hourly basis here. I mean, I can't tell you, well, I can tell you, but you'd never believe it, but I can't tell you how many times we've looked at a plan document, said to the client, hey, you know, your discretionary authority language is really lacking. And the client said, it's good enough. Well, guess what? This case underscores it's not good enough. So this was an ASO, obviously Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts. The administrative services agreement, not the plan document, but only the ASA, provided the ASO with discretionary authority to interpret facts as they relate to the plan document. But again, that language was not in the plan document.
So the plan document is seen by the member. The ASA is never seen by the member.
No, and in fact, if a member or provider does request a copy of the ASA, the standard answer is no way. Why do you need to see that? You don't. But, you know, unfortunately here it had language that the SPD didn't. But the SPD did have language saying that Blue Cross Blue Shield would make coverage determinations, otherwise known as fiduciary determinations.
Which in my mind, if you're making the coverage determination, I could see where someone would think, well, that's giving me discretionary authority, sort of.
Absolutely, but in reality, the court said it's not. I mean, you can say whether something's medically necessary or not, but the court essentially equated making the decision to just sending out a letter, putting your name on that letterhead. But when it comes to the discretionary authority, that needs to be specific. So here, because the plan administrator did not, in fact, have the proper discretion under the SPD, there was no deference in court to the plan administrator's discretion. Therefore, the court reviewed the case de novo, meaning from scratch, meaning we don't care what the plan administrator said. We, the court, are going to look at it just starting over.
So the court has the discretion.
Yes, and, you know, as we've seen in numerous cases through the years, especially lately, courts err on the side of the patient. Because really, you know, ERISA is designed to protect the patient. After all, it's not designed to protect health plans. It gives health plans certain rights, but at the end of the day, it protects patients and plan assets. How does this affect you? Well, plan language, for one. Another one is of course, fiduciary duties. I mean, if your plan administrator is not making the right decisions, whether it's because he doesn't have the right discretion or because it's just simply an unreasonable determination, that's going to be a problem also. And, you know, we've been kind of shamelessly plugging the FIA group throughout this entire webinar, and this is just another time when we kind of have no choice to do that. I mean, fiduciary determinations are tough. Plan language is tough. But when you have someone who knows what they're doing, it gets a heck of a lot easier.
So I know, Chris, there's some crazy stuff going on in California. You seem to like this California case. What's happened out there, and how is it going to affect our clients?
So look, I mean, so the California government agency is basically bringing suit for penalties against administrators who aren't sort of properly following the procedures surrounding independent medical reviews. In fact, they've proposed $8 million in penalties, almost $4 million against one administrator. It's fascinating as the IROs and things continue to develop, as we continue to see states looking for ways to attack self-funded benefit plans. Anyone holding sort of that fiduciary burden or that burden to defend their decisions is going to be seeing more and more attacks from more and more areas.
So wait, so in this case, just so I understand, so now every patient, as everyone knows, if it's a clinical review, not legal, but on a clinical review, you have an external IRO, right?
Yep.
So the ACA obviously offered that. We have an external IRO. The plans pay for the external IROs, not members, so there's no reason not to do it if your claim is denied in a final internal appeal.
Exactly.
So now California is having sanctions. If what? The administrator or the plan don't give specific medical records as required?
Exactly.
Well, doesn't it make sense for the plan to give these medical records to the IROs? I mean, why are they saying this? Is it because people are ignoring the request by the IROs to get the information?
Yeah, I mean, look.
How does it affect our clients in the end?
It's not uncommon, right? In some of these cases, it was that they didn't provide them within 15 calendar days. So, I mean, what they're basically saying is, if you don't, you know, follow the rule of the provisions very, very strictly, we're coming after you for, in one case, $4 million in penalties.
So this is something that our TPAs and our client employee benefit plans and our brokers in California should look at. So, folks, again, really simple. It comes down to one thing. Having the ability to outsource this final level appeal, having the ability to have someone else like ourselves make these final determinations, as John has said, and as Chris said, and as Ron alluded to as well. More and more of these cases are going to a courtroom. More and more of these appeals are happening. As we see the burdens putting on employers, burdens being put on the brokers, and burden putting on the administrators to follow certain procedures, you need experts to help you come in, advise you on what your process should be, and then have a fresh new set of eyes that actually understand the process and understand the legality surrounding any particular state and or federal rule as it pertains to that particular plan, assist you. We've had some really good questions. I want to make sure that if anybody has any questions in regards to our PACE service, please feel free to contact myself or Ron or John or Chris. You guys know how to reach us. Our next webinar is going to be on May 12th. At 1 o'clock, hopefully the weather will be much, much nicer than it has been over the past week, let's say, here. But it looks like our weather should be turning out pretty nice over the next couple weeks. Feel free to contact us. On May 12th, I can tell you that one of the big things we're seeing now is pushback relating to carve-outs. We're noticing a lot of that. We're going to spend quite a bit of time on that. But I'm assuming that between now and May 12th, there'll be even more cases that come out. We'll make sure, based on all the feedback we receive from you folks, we'll make sure we bring that up. I want to make sure I give a special shout-out, as I promised I would, to my friends right down the street at Boris Law Insurance, who
who I guess listen to our webinars all the time, and also the fine folks at the various offices across the country at Cypress, where I got to speak at their annual symposium last week in Vegas. So many of them came up and said how much they enjoyed hearing Ron and I speak, not necessarily Chris and John, but definitely Ron and I. So I want to give a shout-out to them.
Good
but some good questions that we had related to specifically New York.
Yeah, surcharge.
Right. A bunch of questions came in regards to the New York surcharge, saying how is that different than what we've seen in Michigan, as well as why is it going to – here's the bottom line. What's happening in New York stays in New York. Why – and the question was why wasn't it – why didn't they sue? Well, I don't know why. We can go back into it. I actually did something I'm interested in. Why were there a suit? Did anybody look at that option? All I know is what's going to happen in the Michigan case could affect, will affect future states as to whether or not they decide to file a tax or try to attempt to have a tax. But in order to change a law in New York, it won't just disappear because the case disappears in, let's say, Michigan. Someone would have to take this to court in the state of New York, Ron.
Right, and one other thing which Adam mentioned, and it's a great point, is in Vermont it was clearly an administrative burden, a matter of labor and actual time and resources. And the question in Michigan is it just money or does it require additional administrative burdens, as in labor? The next question then is if they create almost a test where you test the tax, you know, is this a percent being charged? Are we asking the TPA or the plan administrator to put in the effort, or is it somebody else who's doing the work? You know, I don't know how it's going to shake out, but you can imagine there will be some sort of test or list of things you sort of check off. And will New York fit into that checklist? I don't know.
A couple other big comments we got is these cases are overkill, and what the courts are doing, the plan doc should rule. Folks, we all feel the SPD should rule. But let me be very honest. If the SPD rules, we'd be multimillionaires here. Not just 1 million like Ron has. We'd have multiple billion. The reality is this. The SPD would rule if there were no other documents at all out there. If there were no other contracts at all out there. Saying that your SPD controls and it's an ERISA plan, yet you signed a network contract. Somehow that network contract is a fake contract. If you have an EOB that makes no reference to the plan and says XYZ TPA has denied your claim versus saying XYZ TPA administrators for the XYZ employee benefit plan and this employee benefit plan has denied your claim. If you make the member think the TPA denied the claim and not the plan denied the claim, then you're acting as the plan. So, yes, you're right. The SPD should rule, but it's actually actions by us, all of us, outside of the terms of the plan, where there is confusion, where there is ambiguity, when a plan set is when an administrator or a plan is acting one way, even though the plan doc says something else, the court is going to look at not what you say you are, but the way you actually act. And that's why it's important that you follow process and have the right procedure in place. As always, on behalf of Chris, John, Ron, and myself, thank you so much. Enjoy your spring, and we'll see you in a month. Thank you.